The following pod contains spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
As an imported Asian adoptee or hyphenated Asian, are you looking for stories and people that you can relate to? If yes, then check out The Universal Asian. The Universal Asian is an open platform run in the magazine style with written articles, poetry, prose, photos, art, and videos on a variety of topics. No topic is off limits. They host online events that showcase what members of our Universal Asian community are doing or provide support through how-tos or discussions on topics of interest. Visit and subscribe at theuniversalasian.com or follow them on your preferred social media platform. Join the Universal Asian community today.
Hey, if you really want to support us, there's a couple of ways. One, you could follow or subscribe to our show on wherever you listen to podcasts. Two, buy us a coffee. Any monetary donation goes into the production of the show, ensuring our content is as high quality as possible. Go to realasianpodcast.com/support.
Hi, my name is Jen Sager. I am from San Jose, California, and I am Filipino-American. Asian-American representation matters because I think as this country becomes more and more diverse, it's important to have voices that will advocate for our specific needs for our communities. And I think that it also provides more diverse examples for Asian American children about, you know, what opportunities are open to them and showing them different ways to succeed rather than just the, you know, typical stereotypes that used to box us in. Seeing Asian American representation in things like movies gives me a sense of belonging. There's a lot of joy and pride when I see our cultures being celebrated. And I think it's comforting to see characters go through the same struggles and knowing that I'm not alone in those experiences.
Aww. Thank you so much, Jen.
Yeah, that was a sweet message.
That was beautiful. That's my friend Sager. Definitely everything that she said right there is completely on point.
100%.
Alrighty. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Real Asian Podcast. And today we are talking about Wong Kar-wai's film, The Grandmaster. She's not a newcomer because she's actually been featured in one of our episodes already, but I would say this is her first formal episode. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
So I'm Ray, and we have another returning champion, Renee.
Yo, what's up?
And then we have Pragya. Hi, Pragya.
Hello. Hi, guys.
Welcome.
Hello, everyone. I'm really excited to be here.
Pragya, can you introduce yourself to our listeners? Do a quick introduction to yourself.
So my name is Pragya. I am Indian American. I moved here when I was like 6 years old. So I have fun little perspective of not fitting in here, not fitting in there, but also fitting in everywhere. I come from a film studies and media studies background. I've worked in games and tech, and I'm a close collaborator of Renee's. And
So that's how you got in, huh?
That's right.
Oh, for sure. No, I mean, I think that's a story for another day, though. But and now I work in the general creative field, providing graphic design and all sorts of things. And I'm really excited to be here because movies are my passion, like that meme.
And they definitely are your passion because before leading up to this recording, Pragya and I had a creative dispute in terms of which version of The Grandmaster I should be watching.
We had differences.
We had differences. Unbeknownst to me, there was two versions of it. And I thought, okay, well, if there's an American version that's available, I might as well watch that. And she vehemently disagreed, was like, no, if you watch that, I will shun you away from all things Asian and take away your Asian American card. I think she threatened my family at some point. I don't know.
That's exactly what I did. That's what I do every day.
It was a revealing, but also very enlightening experience for me. I was like, okay, I think I brought on the right person here.
It was a Mushu moment, right?
There you go. It was a
Mushu. Yes. It was a Mushu moment. Dishonor on you, dishonor your family.
Yeah. And Renee was just like, I'm just going to sit here.
I was third party. I came in midstream. I didn't know what the fuck was going on. I was like, okay, I'm just going to go back to eating my lunch very quietly over here.
I mean, I think it'll be fun when we start talking about the movie and I tell you guys which parts were left out.
But you'll just have to wait to the back half.
I know, you will, yeah.
In that respect, I made sure I watched the original Chinese version. So for those of you that don't know, there's essentially three rumored four versions, because I think the rumored fourth version is like a four-hour version of the film. But there's like three different versions of the Grandmaster that's out there. There's the original Chinese cut that runs 130-ish minutes, correct? Mm-hmm. And then there's the one that was released in the International Berlin Film Festival, which I think Wong Kar-wai only shaved off about 15 minutes or so. And then there's the American version that was basically butchered by the Weinstein Company.
It was scissor-handed.
The whites are at it again.
I mean, we can discuss about what was cut, but
there's three versions. So the American version, I think, is on YouTube and it's on Netflix and stuff like that. Obviously, so it's available. But I didn't know that there was three versions. So for those of you out there listening, we're going to talk mainly, if not exclusively, about the Chinese version, and then, like we said, Pragya is going to kind of go over the key differences between the American and the Chinese version. Really, why it's important to be able to distinguish, to have distinguished between the two. And if you truly wanted to respect the arts and you truly wanted to respect Wong Kar-wai and the movie in itself, you can watch the American version, but you definitely want to watch the Chinese version more importantly than the American version, if you wanted to get the true essence of the Grandmaster. So I wanted to go over the big takeaways for the film. But before we get into that, Renee, kind of go over, let's talk about some of your overall take of the movie.
Right. The Grandmaster, directed by Wong Kar-wai, starring Tony Leung and Xing Xi, was filmed over 20 months in the course of 4 years. And this is a very long production timeline. It's definitely not the longest. But basically, it wasn't enough to just act the part. You actually had to pay respect to martial arts. You know, Wong Kar-wai famously says that Grandmaster movie is so much more than just an action film. It is his love letter to martial arts. He's been a huge fan for many years, and so this was basically his opus, if you will. This film is like any other Wong Kar-wai film. You can spot it from a mile away. His signature filmmaking techniques is like a thumbprint, and his special type of filmmaking techniques can be able to be seen from anywhere, starting from the way that he uses color to convey character emotions, framing within frames motifs, where basically, you know, one of the first scenes, like within 9 minutes of the scene, when Tony Leung is as character Ip Man and his wife are, you know, in their boudoir. And you can be able to see him peeking in, through like the windows and through the framing of the building and things like that. He does this throughout many of his different films, and so this is definitely something that you can continue to see here. It basically, you could freeze frame each still, and it becomes a painting. And this artistic mastery is actually part in Wong Kar-wai's longtime collaborators, production designer William Chung, who he makes sure is a part of every single film, where he does the set designs, the costume designs, and things like that. And longtime collaborator, cinematographer Christopher Doyle, who he has recorded films at least 7 times with, all the way to the swelling crescendos and the beautiful mixture of music. And you can be able to hear the different types of music from traditional Chinese operas, all the way to, you know, like 1950s type of, you know, more modern mixes in there. So, you know, Wong Kar-wai is just well world renowned for all of these different things, but also as a director. He has collaborated with Tony Leung many, many times, where basically if you're walking onto a set with Wong Kar-wai, he doesn't give you a script. You're just basically walking in blind. And a lot of this is because he wants to be able to have this improvisation and organic feel to the characters. And
it's because he forgot, that's why. He's like, script, what's that?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's definitely a very unconventional way. But the only reason why that actors continue to work with Wong Kar-wai is because of just how beautiful the production is at the end of the day.
It's a very artistic display of martial arts that really focuses on, like, the impact, you know, what I noticed when I was watching it, of each kick, the footwork, the punches, or the impact of the bodies. And it's almost kind of like he shot it in a way, Wong Kar-wai and Christopher Doyle shot it in a way where it's like very, it was like a dance. In a lot of senses, it is. It's choreography in its own right. It's like a different type of choreography. And I was just amazed at how the close-up shots of, like, the screw from the wall, like, unscrewing itself.
The train scene was amazing.
Yeah, the train, yes. Yeah. And I was just such zoom in of those impacts. And I was like, wow, this is so artistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, Wong Kar-wai is definitely well known for making it about the, like, almost like art house type of experimental filming.
Even though it's about martial arts.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's just so gorgeous in the way that he kind of slows things down and, you know, does, like, manipulation of the focus of the aperture of the camera, things like that. Like, we don't normally talk about, like, the filmmaking in a lot of different films in that sense, but, you know, it's so unique and different. I always, whenever I'm watching it on my computer, for an example, I always feel like, oh my God, is my computer, like, stuttering or something? Like, I feel like there's frames missing out of this or something. But no, it's just his style. He's always like that. He always slows things down, bleeds things out, and it's just gorgeous.
Is his distinct style is that top down camera view of a lot of the actors, like, because I noticed that too a lot in The Grandmaster, did that with, like, Ip Man and Gong Er, and just that shot where it's, like, constantly showing their mainly, like, the forehead view, if you will, but then, like, conveys just, like, the face. Is that a signature thing of his?
Yes, it definitely is.
He works with Christopher Doyle on a lot of his films, and the cinematography, like the way that we were talking about the frames within frames and the sort of grit and the colors and the lighting, mm-hmm. and the lighting specifically not being artificial, he will use lighting from within the set. Those are all very trademark Christopher Doyle sort of signatures, and he's a funny guy. You guys should, like, look him up, listeners too, and, like, learn about him. He moved from Australia to Hong Kong and, like, lived his whole life in Hong Kong and continues to be there. So he's an interesting one. But yeah, so what you're talking about with the framing of the characters and their faces versus, like, you know, like a top-down view, I just wanted to add from listening to you guys that, like, with Wong Kar-wai, when you have these, like, extremely stylized shots, they're not just empty just because they look nice. Like, it's very much about, like, directing your attention to something specific, you know, slowing you down or speeding you up, and it's got, like, an emotional quality to it, and I think that's what makes it so, like, genius as you experience it.
Tell your biggest takeaway from the film.
Oh my God. My biggest takeaway from the film, I think, so as you guys already said, the martial arts were treated very sensitively, and there's so many martial arts stories out there, but it's a little bit rare to see martial arts within their own breeding ground, within the area and the context that they come out of. And I think this film does a really good job of looking at all of the different martial artists, the schools, and the different things that shape those schools. I don't want to do any
masters.
Yeah, right? Like, the whole idea of grandmaster kind of, like, reaches a peak in the film. Like, what does it mean to be a grandmaster? How did we get here? How does anybody get here? What does it require? Which we'll get into because I saw some of your favorite quotes and I'm excited. I think my other biggest takeaway was just that there is, I think, like, a deep philosophy to martial arts that we all always talk about, right? Like, martial arts have, like, you know, action, but they also have philosophy. And I think this film does such a great job of bringing the philosophy to the forefront and making the whole plot about that.
My biggest takeaway definitely was about how Wong Kar-wai continues to want to be able to highlight just like the strength and resilience of women who shape their own destiny. And, you know, and I feel like I'm the token person who always brings it up, like, every time we do an episode. But, I mean, he just does such a remarkable job of framing Gong Er's storyline that he does it. And he even does this beautiful justice to Ip Man's wife's mm-hmm. storyline, too, mm-hmm. actually.
Yeah.
And even though, she actually is a pretty big part of his life, but, you know, not a grandmaster or a martial artist. And they talk about that as well in how, you know, martial arts isn't passed down to daughters, and they will even pass it on to son-in-laws over before sending it to daughters. But he does such a beautiful job of just creating these overarching storylines that built this three-dimensional character. That was definitely my biggest takeaway.
Yeah, speaking of which, my biggest takeaway was Zhang Ziyi. She stole the show, honestly. I cared a lot more about her character and her plot line. Powerful, skilled, she's beautiful. I just love her. And I just liked her story arc, even though, you know, it starts off with Ip Man in that memorable one versus many fight scene in the rain. It's kind of like, oh man, this Ip Man guy is badass. But you kind of realize, like, oh, you know, people just kind of test him so many times, and he mm-hmm. just has no choice to like defend himself or to prove himself. But like with Zhang Ziyi or Gong Er, she's like having to take control of her own narrative and, you know, take her own journey into her own hands. Even though all the men around her are like saying the opposite, telling her, go get married, blah, 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 you know, fall back into societal expectations and stuff like that. I don't know, for me, I was like, fuck that. Killed your dad. You go get your revenge.
I think, it's so funny that you liked her so much because, you know, we had our creative differences. And then when you said you liked Z's character, I was like, oh, really? Because yeah. When we get into the differences in the film, one of the big things that you lose is the sensitivity with which the female characters are portrayed.
Yeah.
And specifically want to say that, like, she's such a leader. Like, everybody in the faction, like, has their opinions on what she should do, but she gets the last say, and she can be rude to whoever she wants. She gets to lead the procession. She is so, like, highlighted as this woman who is, like, really, like, you know, just no different from any of the other sort of grandmaster male characters. She's running it.
Yeah. I'll tell you, though, she does have the hots for Ip Man, though.
She does. She does have the hots for Ip Man.
Yes, she definitely does. I think they did such a good job of handling that, the gravitas of her feelings. And mm-hmm. It was so emotional. Sorry, hold on a second.
Are you getting emotional over there?
I'm choking up over here, my God. It was just I really love the way that they just teased out that storyline about mm-hmm. and framed it. And basically, you know, like, the Gong family absolutely existed, absolutely had their own style and things like that. But Gong Er, right, Zhang Ziyi's character, she may not have actually really existed. And the brothel fight scene was just amazing because what was interesting was, you know, Gong Er was like, am I even supposed to be here? Why did you bring me to a brothel? And her father says, you know, what's the harm in seeing with your own eyes, right?
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that he had this respect for his daughter in that same sense. It really was like not only a dance, but, you know, there was the carnality of it, of like just the visceral feeling between the two characters kind of blooming. And some people even say that it was, in a sense, a sex scene mm-hmm. too, because of just how physical it was. And
sex with clothes on.
Yes, exactly. You know, they're exchanging blow for blow. And
impact on impact.
One of the most beautiful scenes where you could really palpably see it. Because if you were just watching the action, okay, it was easy to get kind of caught up and swept away by that. But there was a scene where the frame slows, you know, the camera slows down and you can be able to see that their nose
oh, yeah.
touch each other. Mm-hmm. They're just spinning.
I thought they were just, they should have just like given a small peck.
Yeah, it was, oh gosh, it's just so beautiful. I really, really loved this movie.
And by the way, about what you said about her not existing, she's sort of a mix of a couple of different, like, sort of national heroines, right? And her plot is a real one. Someone killed, like, a woman's father. She gets married. She wants to get revenge. The husband is like, nah, like, and 10 years later, it's still nah. So she goes and does it herself. She turns herself in or she gets caught. And the whole, like, the government lets her off because they're like, well, he killed her dad. So she gets to do that back.
That's what I'm saying.
And that's exactly what Ray said.
Yeah. Yeah. Said, fuck that. Go get your vengeance.
Yeah. You go, girl. Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of which, though, Renee, share with us your favorite line from the movie, because this is one of my favorites, too.
Yeah. So one of my favorite lines is because Longer's character is driven by this revenge arc, she finally gets to be able to have this amazingly epic train fighting scene. As soon as she beats Ma-san, he's like, relinquish the Gong family legacy. I return to you. And she mm-hmm. looks back at him, you know, from on high, looking down at him, and just basically kind of spits it out. It's like, let's be clear. I didn't return it. I took it back myself. Ooh. And I was like, oh, damn. I was like,
yes, bitch.
Yeah.
I loved that. God, it was so epic. I mean, like, just the delivery, the look, the feel, the ambiance, like, the framing, it was just so perfect. It was like, if I was in a theater with everyone else, I'm sure everyone would have been just screaming and like, yes.
It would have been like, oh, moment. Like,
yes. Was, yes.
And then you see his reaction. He's like, his face is still in the snow. He's like, oh, okay.
I mean, he's an interesting character, right? Like, he's not one that you like, but he, I don't know if you picked it up, but he's an orphan and he's an orphan yeah. from the war that precedes the start of the movie. And her dad picks him up, and so they are raised as siblings. So even though he does make, like, choices that are the wrong choices, especially based on the philosophy that his grandmaster is trying to teach him, like, there are parts where, well, that very scene is about how he didn't realize what the secret was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's, like, a lot in that final expression where he's like, well, I messed up, now I die.
Well, you know, it's, yeah, absolutely, and it, I mean, like, who doesn't have that rebellious streak in themselves, you know, because basically he's rebelling against not only his master, but he's rebelling against his father in mm-hmm. all nonsenses, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, like, how many times has your dad told you something and you're like, you know what, I'm not going to do that. You don't know what you're talking about, old man.
Yeah. You know what? Let's be clear. You didn't return it. I took it back myself. And then my dad's like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm like, oh, sorry. I just watched The Grandmaster. Pragya, what's your favorite line from the movie?
So I think I chose this one. I have a couple of favorite lines, and there's been a couple that I have been using in my daily life too, but we're just going to go with this one. It's in life, ability isn't everything. Some thrive in light, others in shadow. The times make us what we are. And my favorite sort of part of this line is the whole idea that the times make us what we are.
Yeah.
Because the film is so grounded in, like, its historical time period, right? And you end up wondering with Gonger and her, you know, revenge plot and Ip Man having to, you know, end up in Hong Kong. Like, if it was different times, how would these characters have ended up, you know? How would their lives have been shaped? What would have even ended up happening to the martial arts? Like, would we have lost the Gong martial arts? I don't know. Yeah. We don't know.
Who knows? Yeah. Would Bruce Lee exist? Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? He probably wouldn't.
I mean, Bruce Lee would exist, but he'd be like, you know, could be like some street vendor or something like that. Like the street vendor that knows Kung Fu.
I watched a lot of interviews with Wong Kar-wai regarding Grandmaster. And he says, I really want to drive this point home. there's a scene where there is a boy looking in through the window very intently, interested in what Ip Man is doing. That could be me, mm-hmm. right? Looking in and appreciating this art, but not only just me, it could be you. Mm-hmm. And I really want people to appreciate and understand and be able to feel like they're drawn into this world of martial arts. And so, you know, I really respected, Wong Kar-wai's kind of opinion. I mean, and a lot of movies that he actually brings up about like the character arc of one character is like, they really love martial arts or something like that. Like reading, watching, or even just kind of like being around it. And so, it was one of the more famous ones is, when in the movie, In the Mood for Love, Maggie Cheung's character, you know, Mrs. Chan, she and Tony Leung's character bond over reading martial arts novels, right? Mm-hmm. So it was just kind of really interesting. If you had been watching and paying attention to Wong Kar-wai's kind of like career in that regard, then you kind of see him dropping hints of, I really want to make a martial arts movie.
Yeah, he was like, he's like, I really want to do martial arts. But he wanted to give it respect, so right. With all the research and preparation that he did.
And it's not his first wuxia film, right? Ashes of Time, which was like 1994, and then there's like a redux later, which I'm not sure if I got the time right, but I hope I did. It follows The Legend of the Condor Heroes, and that's all about martial arts masters. So it starts back then, like way back when is like his interest in this. And then, yeah, there was something interesting you said about how Maggie Chan, Miss Chan is also reading the martial arts books, and that's existing in the Mood for Love world, because after that, when he's shooting Happy Together, he goes to Argentina and he sees like this poster of like Bruce Lee. So he's almost being like brought into this project. Like,
yeah.
So, okay, let me ask y'all then, rank your favorite Wong Kar-wai films.
Okay, Renee, go first.
Really easily for me, my number one is definitely got to be In the Mood for Love. Not only because one of my exes introduced it to me, but wait, it was also...
Is it because your ex introduced it to you?
It was one of the first that I met. Like, it was one of the first movies that introduced me to Wong Kar-wai.
Oh, okay.
So
thank you very much. Now, bye.
Yeah, exactly. Even though he showed it to me and I don't talk to him ever, right? But it was just kind of like, I still loved this film. It was so beautiful. Gosh, I mean, I rewatched it again recently, and I have like a Blu-ray disc and DVD and everything. I mean, like, I just am so enamored by this film.
Man, what's DVD? What is that?
And so I won't go too much into it. I really think we should probably review that movie. And the next one after that is 2046, which is kind of seen as In the Mood for Love Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
But this is actually probably one of the first films that we see Wong Kar-wai working with Shang Tsui. And it's just, it's beautiful all over again. And it's set in this futuristic world. And one of my favorite scenes is actually when he's whispering into the hole of a tree or a wall or whatever. And it's just like the build up to that moment. It just feels it's overwhelming, actually. A lot of films, I don't get this feeling of being overwhelmed and overcome with just emotion, in the same sense. And so if you haven't seen it, definitely go and see it, but be in the right state of mind for it, because, Wong Kar-wai's movies are definitely on the slower pacing and being able to build things. And then actually my third ranking, even though Grandmaster is phenomenal, has to go all the way back, to one of his, earlier films, Chungking Express, where we see
baby Kaneshiro.
Yes. Oh, yes. Takeshi Kaneshiro. He is, oh my God, heartthrob. And Fei Wong's character, she's so amazing. She's the manic pixie girl before they even made it. And she's just this really sprightly kind of person. And I just love the action scene in there. Of course, Tony Young's in there as well. But oh my gosh, those are my top three.
Nice, nice, nice. Okay, I'm going to go in the opposite direction, because you mentioned Chungking as your third favorite, and I would say it's mine too. And it has my favorite part, okay, like, is like the Indian representation in that film.
Yes. Oh my God.
Because if you haven't watched it, this is like super minor, but there is like this minor drug plot going on where like she has hired some Indian people to smuggle her drugs, and they run away with the drugs. And so in the back, they have like this like Urdu, like speaking relevant to like Bollywood, like referencing. And it's great. It's got like this really gritty like version of Hong Kong. And of course, baby Takeshi Kaneshiro is just like so cute. Like I was watching him and he and his character is also like so funny. The pineapple scene is my favorite. Like I think like I can just relate to characters who are like that. They're like, do you just like, you know, throw away everything that's expired? And he like eats all the pineapples. So that's my third favorite film. And I think like obviously all of the Wong Kar-wai things apply to it, but specifically I think just the chaos of the film is what appeals to me.
It was comedic but also serious, and it was funny. It was just like the timing definitely wasn't nearly the same pacing as it was there, but there were definitely scenes where it kind of slows down as well for you to kind of go ahead and expand the character arcs in even some nonverbal ways. So I really love Chungking Express. It deserves its mantle in the third. Go ahead. What's your number two?
Okay, number two is The Grandmaster, which we're talking about today. I am a sucker for both, like, historical films, but, like, also ones with philosophies. But then on top of that, with Grandmaster, you have such a strong emotional quality for almost all of the characters. And you experience so many different characters, right? Like, there is no, like, one type of martial artist, and I really love that. Where you've got, you know, the reckless ones, you've got the ones that are always doing the thing that they need to do, which is it, you know? And it just shows you, like, you know, you can take a martial arts film and it doesn't have to be, like, a hero narrative or anything. It can just be, like, this, like, soft, like, meditative and almost, like, grieving piece. Though it's cool, like, you don't necessarily feel like you were experiencing grief as you go through it. Or maybe you do, I don't know. And my number one favorite one is Ashes of Time. And that one is, yeah, I really love that film. Like, I love it so much. And that one, I will warn any readers or listeners who decide to go watch it because I said so. You really have to watch to the end of the film. That film is like 120 minutes of stuff. And then it only makes sense in the last 5 minutes. And that's such a Wong Kar-wai quality.
It is. Oh, my gosh. Definitely. You know, like Wong Kar-wai's critics always say, you know, it's not a linear storyline, but it's more cyclical, right? He introduces things. He spins it around. And then you finally come around to full circle. You're like, oh, shit.
Yeah, exactly.
That thing in the very beginning looks like this at the very end. And oh my gosh, it's just, you know, it's so wonderful. I love the way that he tells stories.
Yeah. When we watched that one, my friend and I were both like, we just like jaws drop. We were like, what? And like, it was a moment. So definitely check that one out. Yeah.
Praga, you mentioned the historical context of this film. Something I thought was interesting that you brought about is martial arts with the backdrop of war, immigration. Talk a little bit about that historical context that paints this film for what it is.
So I think that like if you don't have a big like background in the history of Asia, and a lot of us don't because we're not taught in school, or if we are taught, it's like painted with one brush, you won't pick up the very sly sort of historical references in this film. But it starts with a sort of like truce or a reunification or like some sort of agreement between the North and the South. And that's a direct reference to what was happening in China at that time, was the Qing dynasty had been overthrown and you ended up with factions and parties. But the rebellion and the civil war ends, and that's where the movie begins, right? You've got the Master Gong coming in from the North, and he references like, oh, you know, 3 years ago, I did this and we united the school. So now we're in the South. We're at this brothel. The brothel itself is referred to as the Republic Building. And one of the very first scenes is that everyone sort of goes to the brothel. And among rogues, you find good men and you also find grandmasters, or you find masters. And so he's telling you, and you don't necessarily pick it up unless you're like privy to this, is that like these are all the same people. The people who are the martial arts schools and factions are the people who are sort of involved or driving political motivations, are involved with the parties. And this kind of film, I'm sorry, this kind of theme continues throughout the film, because you end up with the Japanese occupation, and Ma San ends up collaborating. Ip Man chooses specifically not to collaborate. He loses two daughters over that, right? And you don't know necessarily where Zhang Zi stands, but there is a moment where the Razor character is on a train with her, and he's being chased by Japanese soldiers. He's been assassinating Japanese soldiers this whole time. Like, that's his role. And that is tied again into the martial arts, because Razor's martial arts is Bajiquan, and Baji is the martial arts of the bodyguards, of the sort of like imperial leaders, but also the Kuomintang. And then towards the end of the film, you see another Razor moment where Razor is being confronted by a group of people, and he has that same fight scene that Ip Man had in the rain. But his thing is, he's in Hong Kong now, and they're saying, like, well, you swore loyalty to the party, and that party is supposed to be the Kuomintang. And he's like, well, this is Hong Kong now. And so he beats them all up. And so Razor's philosophy is very much that, like, unless you can beat me, don't tell me what to do, you know? Mm-hmm. But at the same time...
Exactly. He was a grandmaster.
But yes, so when I said that, my favorite quote was about the light and the shadows. Towards the end of the movie, you do end up with two grandmasters, right? One that works in the shadows that you don't necessarily know about, but he does the three things that are required. He knows, he is, and he teaches. And the only other person that's able to do that is Ip Man. But regardless of, you know, his narrative arc as a martial artist and a grandmaster, you see very clearly how he's grounded in the politics of that era, of the history of the war, obviously. And yeah, I think that's all I should say about that. Any thoughts?
I think you encompassed it so well. Same.
Yeah, plus one. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Annie's Tea Cakes is an Oakland-based food company on a mission to provide plant-based Chinese food options to the world. Wow! As a longtime plant-based eater, Annie started this business to create a way for herself and others to enjoy the foods that are often shared with family but don't fit a plant-based diet. You know, this journey started with vegan Taiwanese pineapple cakes. That sounds amazing, I'll tell you that right now. Follow Annie's Tea Cakes on Instagram or go to annietcakes.com to place your order today.
Have you ever wanted to spend quality time with that special someone? Just you and your partner, enjoying each other's company, cherishing every moment together? But maybe the problem is you don't know what to do, or even worse, you don't have the time to put it together. Well, let me tell you about Experiences by K. Experiences by K is a Bay Area luxury picnic business that can help bring you all the wow factor without all the wow stress. It can be set up at the beach, park, your backyard, and more. Simply go to the website, book your picnic, show up, enjoy those memorable moments. It's also great for birthdays, anniversaries, proposals, you name it. Go to experiencesbyk.com right now to make your reservation and check out Experiences by K on Instagram at Experiences by K.
And now, back to the show.
So anyways, we mentioned at the top of the episode the difference, the various versions of the Grandmaster. Pragya, let's go in deep, pull apart the key differences between the Chinese cut, the original Chinese cut, and the American cut.
Okay, so the biggest issue with the American cut is that you don't have the logic of the film anymore. So it becomes, a whole bunch of fighting scenes, and like you don't know what's driving the characters anymore. So you end up with like this like mystery of the Orient. What are these people thinking? Why are they fighting each other?
A lot of title text as well.
Yeah. Well, the title text is meant to explain, but the thing is that whoever wrote the title text accidentally or maybe like just didn't think about it, but they assumed that we would actually have some meaningful reference to the history that they're referencing, and it's not true. So you just find that the title text tells you something's happened, but unless you're not able to put together like why that happened. You're just like, oh, mm-hmm. This movie is moving me through the plot by just telling me what the plot is in text, you know?
Yeah.
But more than that, I actually wanted to do this in a fun sort of way. So you guys said you really liked Zhang Ziyi, right? Tell me a few of your favorite scenes with her.
Is this, what is it, like, trying to figure out which scenes she is in?
No, because I'm pretty sure as soon as you say a scene that is hers, I'm going to say it was cut.
My favorite scene with Gong Er is definitely the scene where she tells the grandmaster, or not the grandmasters, the uncles, basically, I'm going to go and, you know, take my revenge, right? Like, that whole scene where
the council.
That was cut. That was completely cut.
That doesn't even make sense, right? It doesn't make sense that she does she just become like this ghost that comes in and like seeks revenge, I guess?
Exactly, like, exactly. So you don't know what's at stake anymore for her revenge because it cuts all of the parts that tells you that she's deciding between, you know, living the life that her father wanted her to live, which was a happier life for her, versus her principles and her pride and the martial arts that she's inherited from her father, which is, you know, her point of, like, it's the nexus of her character, is that that pride in what her father has taught her, but it's gone.
What about the scene with Ip Man? Is that still in there?
The brothel one?
Yeah, the brothel one.
So the main brothel fight scene is still in there. It is still
only
in
because
it.
Ip Man is in there.
Yes. So basically all of her parts that are relevant to Ip Man are still in there, but all of her parts that make her a functioning character are gone. My favorite scene, for instance, was that she goes in front of the Buddha and she says, you know, show me a light if this is what my father would, if he understands what's in my heart. That's gone.
Read what's in my heart.
Yeah. And so she sees the light, and that's sort of that, you know, her father does understand what's in her heart. So even if she's going against his wishes, he still loves his daughter and he still understands, right? But no, that's also gone.
What about the snow, with her practicing in the snow?
Yeah, so the practicing in the snow is actually added to. So the story becomes quite different because then what they've added to it and how they have represented it then sort of takes away from her narrative as this like strong female character with her own motivations and like complex thoughts to like, oh, here's my history with my father and here's me in love with Ip Man. And so a lot of people who saw the American cut thought that Gong Er was just meant to be a extramarital romance. And that's clearly not what her character is about. Like, yes, she falls in love with him, but that is something that she gives up because there's more things that are, like, you know, priority or important to her.
I fucking hate Weinstein for doing this. Because when you take into account, like, how she was introduced to the United States, it was through Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and it wasn't her first film. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite films of hers is The Road Home, which actually is a more subtle kind of character building. And so within Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, she's this young waif kind of person who seduces, you know, like, the main protagonist in it, and, you know, has, like, this star-crossed lover kind of crazy storyline as well. And basically she can't get away from that narrative of who her as an actress is, and feels like she basically in the United States gets typecasted because she's also in like Rush Hour 3 or something that also has that same kind
Rush
of... Rush Hour 2. Yeah, Ray over here with his Rush Hour knowledge. There you go.
I'm all over Rush Hour.
And, you know, she has a similar storyline where she basically is just this like vindictive bitch who only uses her sexuality. And, you know, and so at Newsweek, actually, so I'm kind of transitioning to another topic. Newsweek actually does this really good kind of interview with Shang-Chi back in 2013 around the Grandmaster and a time frame and release. And basically, you know, she comes in and she's like, you know what, I chose not to be in Hollywood. And while she's the it person, she gets to kind of choose. And I love that, right? That continues to be who she is in her narrative. She's like, you know what, I'm only going to pick up roles that make sense to me and what I want to be able to do. And so it almost feels like, however, to me personally, kind of person looking out, looking in, it feels like Hollywood, in a sense, has kind of blackballed her into being only typecasted into this one typical role. And so, you know, so in that same regard, she could have been like, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and just do whatever it takes to break it in. But she was, in her own merits, like this person who was really incredible at actress and choreography, kind of doing all these other different things. And so she knew she could be able to stay within her own lane over in Asia, Hong Kong films, China films, right?
I mean, she probably experienced the ugly beast that is Hollywood. And she's like, oh, actually, I don't really want to be in this.
Right, exactly.
Well, the other thing is like what Renee is, like what you are sort of touching on, and I just want to clarify, is that this movie is a Chinese film. And the Chinese cut of it is able to imagine her as this very complex character with internal motivations and as someone who like doesn't necessarily defer to societal norms or anything like that. And in the Hollywood version, the American cut, she is flattened to be the dragon lady that we expect. And that's almost a question of like, what does Hollywood allow women to be, right? Because we are always having this conversation about strong female characters. And so I think it's very interesting to see this film coming out of China where she's allowed to be, you know, multifaceted, and then it getting cut into her being like vindictive, bitchy dragon lady, as you
said. Right, exactly. I feel like the only time that she was actually able in the United States Hollywood filming, the only time she really gets to have like a more well-rounded character, and I feel terrible saying this, is Memoirs of a Geisha.
And that film already has so much.
It's so whitewashed and terrible. Oh my God, they gave her like blue eye contacts. And I was like, what the fuck is this? You know, and so so I would definitely say like Hollywood just doesn't know what to do with strong female leads, just like in general. And only more recently are we finally starting to get to this point, because we're also letting storytellers be women. Mm-hmm. We're also letting them be the filmmakers and the directors on the executive boards of these decisions. And that's why you get to be able to have more nuanced characters who are strong female leads who are also Asian. So, you know, like, I just think it's really interesting how Hollywood has kind of come a long way. You still have some aspects of Charlie Chan-isms through more global blockbuster, and you get this whitewashing, right? I mean, like, you've got Tilda Swinton as like the ancient one in Marvel, mm-hmm. and then of course OG Asian actress Scarlett Johansson
in Ghost in a Shell, right? Definitely that Japanese representation. Yes,
exactly.
So I'm curious then, in your perspective, because Wong Kar-wai gave some I guess not permission, but like some concession to the American version, do you put some responsibility on Wong Kar-wai needing to feeling that he needs to water it down for American audiences?
No.
It's so interesting, because in the interview that I saw him, he actually says about how not very many filmmakers get a chance to actually be able to tell their story again. And he feels like he did it more streamlined, but I just feel like that was such a BS. That was like such a BS thing to say, like very politically sounding, because he doesn't want it. Because he's worked with Miramax a really long time, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I think it was. I think he was just saying something to preserve sort of his like general business contacts and relationships, while also keeping it vague enough that it's like it's kind of an insult. And if you watch Bong Joon-ho's interviews, it's the same way, but that dude is like very much more in your face. Like, he will say stuff like he called the Oscars a regional award show. He was like, I don't know what the big deal is. So with these guys, you got to really learn to like read between the lines, right? Like what they're saying, and then the context they're saying it in.
Such an Asian thing, by the way. It's such an Asian thing to like, there's like layers between it, like of how they how they say it, right? They're not talking shit directly, but they're also not hiding it either.
Yeah,
they're
like shade. Yeah.
At the time, Wong Kar-wai was probably, and he said it, he tried to come from a place where it's like, I'm gonna try to, you know, he didn't expect American audiences to understand the historical context of everything and the somewhat convoluted storylines and how everything is interconnected and nonlinear. So he like tried to make it in a way. He probably took it on as like a personal challenge for himself. He's like, maybe if there's a way that I can like capture the essence of the film to American audiences, but obviously it didn't translate over very well.
Yeah.
Right. I'm wondering if since The Grandmaster, this is the latest directorial film of his. I wonder if that plays into it, why he hasn't put out a film in a while. If any of you guys happen to know why he hasn't put anything out in a while, because he had a stretch where he was putting out everything that he was putting out his goal.
He got into doing like TV shows. Not like she's like now doing TV shows or stuff, but there was something in production with Amazon that got canceled. So that was happening up until quarantine hit us all. And then I think before that was like a small break. And then recently there was a release of like all like a bunch of his movies as like a DVD set, which is like super high quality. So I don't think that he just like quit doing films or something.
No, he's definitely more of a producer type now. And so that's definitely where he's kind of pivoted his, but also he's also known for having like these really long stretches of doing a lot of research on certain things. So it's very possible that he's just got something.
Like the next grandmaster is brewing.
The grandmaster of IT services.
Exactly. More Indian representation.
10 cent. Oh my God.
So Annapurna Pictures, the studio that produced the American version of the film along with the Weinstein Company, they actually created a 23-minute special on the Grandmaster, and in it, they not only have, you know, people from the film like Tony Leung, Cheng Shiyi, and Wong Kar-wai talking about it, but they also have other people in it, such as Keanu Reeves. It also has Shannon Lee, who's Bruce Lee's daughter, and ruined also by Giancarlo, who's an anti-masker hater. Anyway, so you know, but what's amazing about this 23-minute special is, you know, it's actually interesting to see Keanu Reeves just like gushing about Wong Kar-wai in it. And so I definitely would suggest going and watching it if you get a chance. But Tony Leung actually says that he only started learning doing martial arts at 47. He learned it for this film. And I think that was something that's really interesting. You can't even detect that. Because the way that the flow is so beautiful, just like, you know, like the embodiment of the philosophy and things like that. And so a part of it was he took on this role because he was such a huge fan of Bruce Lee, like since the age of 10. And so he said the way he plays Ip Man, actually, he embodied Bruce Lee because Bruce Lee was such a a huge philosopher as well.
Philosophizer.
Philosophizer.
That's like an insult.
Oh, now he's a philosophizer. Okay, let's go into our closing segment. We're going to go into just a simple categories section, category styles. And we have two categories here. We'll go through each of our takes in terms of who or what should have gotten more screen time if there was a four-hour version out there. So, Renee, you go ahead and start.
Bruce Lee. I'm just kidding. I mean, I know it's an Ip Man movie, but Ip Man is known for being Bruce Lee's master. And so I was like trying to figure out.
Bruce Lee is meant to be the little kid, right?
I think so. I was like, ooh, which one is he? Which one is he? Oh, is he sitting right next to him in that photo that they're taking? Yeah. Right, exactly. So I was like, okay, cool. But anyway, no, I actually really, really would have loved to see more of Ip Man's wife. She was. So one of the things that they said was like, okay, so Ip Man never remarried after her death. And a part of it was because at that time, you know, because it's a period piece based off of the moment during the wars and whatnot. Basically, a lot of men would cheat on their wives or have extramarital affairs and things like that. And they actually said that Ip Man didn't because of the way that his wife actually treated her. Many times the men treated their wives as pets, but in this same other regard, it actually shows that Ip Man's wife treats him as a pet in a sense. And so that's kind of the reason why he was so loyal to her. And it wasn't until when they closed the borders between Hong Kong and China mainland that basically he never gets a chance to be able to see her again. And that's the time when he ends up does having an affair, and they don't show it in the film, obviously, because, you know, but basically that was the only time where he did have one more son. But then basically once after his wife dies and they open the borders again, all of his sons actually come from his wife come and actually live in Hong Kong and help to establish Ip Man And things like that. So anyway, going back to who deserved more screen time, I definitely think I would have loved to see more of Ip Man's wife kind of coming and blooming. But of what they did, I thought they did justice. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt that they really did her justice too. You know, we're talking about strong characters and we talk about Z, but like his wife represents a different kind of strong character. And quick note here, the first opera scene is like really setting the stage between him and his wife where he grabs her hand. Yes. That is taken out in the American cut.
No, yes. Are you kidding me? It was such, so well beautiful. As, oh my
there's
God.
A note in the Chinese cut that she dies. That is also taken out. So there's a lot where it's just like, what's left of the movie?
You know, I'm really disappointed in you, Wong Kar-wai, that you didn't think that American audiences would be able to handle right. it.
Because we really just wanted it. We didn't want whatever the other thing was.
I know, apparently.
Okay, so I'm a big fan of The Razor, which I don't know if that's clear yet or not, because I keep talking about
The Razor.
Yeah, so he's played by Chang Chen, and you were talking about how, you know, Tony Leung trained for the role. Chang Chen also did. And he did like Bajiqua, like 3 hours a day in the morning, 3 hours at night. And he got so good at it that he actually placed in like a competition.
Nice.
And, yeah, it was. So he took it very seriously as well. But more than that, I think the Razor character really contextualizes Ip Man by giving us like a foil. Right. So if you're able to pay attention to him, like you see all of the points at which he is a foil. Ip Man is living his life and like, you know, with his family, and he's being moved around by the war to the point that he ends up in Hong Kong and then in exile. The Razor character also ends up in Hong Kong, but he's part of the Kuomintang, and his ending up there is because everything was expelled. That was like dissident after the sort of reconsolidation of power. So you have like these like various like forces moving people. And I think the Razor was just such a cool character for like just bringing the film into its context and its moment. So I think he's underrated severely. And he's hot. He's so hot.
Oh, absolutely. So I know. Super hot.
Yeah.
This is not the first time, right? That Sang Si-yi and the, you know, and he like star in a movie together, right?
And same thing with Tony Leung too.
I was really happy to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So. For mine, mine's very particular. Mine's very specific. Mine's the old man that Gong Er is talking to.
Yeah, he's the one with the monkey, right?
No. He's not the executioner. He has a very small part.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know who you're talking about.
And he's just basically telling her not to seek revenge and to like go get married. But his acting was just so on point. I was like, man, this guy is really making the most out of his screen time. I just would like to see him go on about his daily life, just having that same amount of passion. I mean, even though what he was telling Gong Er was completely ridiculous,
he was really old guard.
There you go.
Yeah, he was selling it for sure. But in all seriousness, no, I think more screen time. I would have liked to see more of Kung Lee. So I don't know if you guys know, I didn't even work with. He just happened to train at the same gym that I was working at like years ago. I think this is before he landed this role. Although I don't know when he was shooting, when they shot this movie. But he always talked about how he wanted to be in movies. But I worked at one of his fights in San Jose. He was a nice guy. He was always kind of like, he would just say hello, talk to me a little bit. And he would always do like the high altitude training thing where you'd wear the mask.
Who did he play in the movie?
He played one of the main guys that Ip Man was fighting in the rain. Like the last guy.
Oh, he plays
that
him.
that he knocked into the fence.
Yes. The MMA fighter.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, hey, Kung Lee.
So I was watching the interview where Tony Leung says that he didn't know. So that fight scene in the rain like went on for a really long time. It was really draining. And he said that he didn't know he was going to be fighting an actual fighter until like that day. And so when he comes on the scene, and he's huge, massive. Tony Leung's like, oh, yeah. Shit.
He's like, no, I got to test that kung fu.
I better come correct.
The Wing Chun.
Okay, speaking of which, though, the guy with the monkey, okay? So our next category is I'd watch a spin-off movie of this character. Definitely for me, the executioner and his monkey. He, number one, he has a monkey. And it just begs the question, why can't we have more monkeys on our shoulders? and just have more pet monkeys. I know they throw poo and everything, but I just think it would be nice to have more monkeys around. But yes, but other than that, though, like his very skillfulness with the blade, and he like was able to cut a bunch of people without mm-hmm. actually cutting them and just cutting their shirts, very thick shirts. It seemed like,
because it's cold up there.
Yeah, exactly.
Their North Face, right? That's what it was. He was cutting up their North Face, and you're like, oh shit, come on guy, this cost $200.
So can you guess the punchline on the old man with the monkey? He was not in the American cut. So,
oh, man.
So there's a few parts where he tells his story and how he ends up as.
Yeah, like how he ended up. He was the executioner during the first Sino-Japanese War. And then there was like nothing left for him to do.
Yep. So that gets cut out, as well as the hair. The hair, you know, she burns her hair.
I don't know about giving burnt hair as a gift. I just...
No, that's like a very traditional thing. It's like a thing that people do with, like, you know...
I know.
Star-crossed lovers and people are not going to see each other.
I know, but have you ever smelled burnt hair? It's always like, oh.
I mean, you know, people keep, like, ashes of people who have died, right? You're sitting here having an issue.
You're not going to open that box and just start sniffing it, Ray. You're
like, that was supposed to be a very emotional moment. That's what I would do. In the film. You're like, I don't know about this burnt hair.
I was just thinking, I was like, oh man, that probably smells really bad.
So that was, it was breaking the fourth wall for Ray there, but yeah.
Renee, spin-off character.
So, but I'm going to ask you a quick question though, Ray. Is the reason why you have an aversion to burnt hair in a box is because you had like some sort of secret admirer who would like stuff cuts of her hair in your locker or something?
Yeah.
Is that why?
And like tied it up with a makeshift doll of myself around its neck. And I was like, uh-oh.
Oh my God.
I'm like, what the hell is this?
Shout out to Ray's secret admirer. Yeah.
And then I smelled it.
All right. My person that I would want to see a spinoff for is obviously Gong Er. You know, I guess it would be like a prequel of like, you know, montage
prequel
shots.
To It Man, yeah.
Exactly. Of like her father teaching her at a really young age, you know, martial arts and things like that. And going up against schoolyard bullies where she would just beat the shit out of them and things like that. I'm like, yes, character development. I would definitely watch a Gong Er movie.
I could totally see that. You should pitch that.
I'm going to pitch it to the Weinstein Company. Let's go.
Let's fix your sins. Give them a chance for reparations.
Or they'll just leave you at the door. Pragya, what's your spinoff movie?
Yeah, so I think I've been boosting the razor a little too much this episode. So I'm going to choose Ip Man's wife. I really liked her character. She was super beautiful. And just the way that like the relationship between her and Ip Man is shown, I think was like very sensitive. Because my favorite part was when he agrees to go to the north to see Gong Er. And like she like knows what's going on. And she knows that it's kind of like there's like a tension there for her. And you see her in the picture, like even though Ip Man like, you know, puts his arm on her like shoulder, like she kind of like has like a sort of like she's about to cry moment. And like I just thought that was such a like not like relatable necessarily, but like such a human emotion and like way of dealing with like her husband, where she's still trying to do it with tenderness. But like there's like, you know, obviously this threat. But I do think it's cute. Well, threats to their marriage. It's a literal threat to their marriage. Yeah. But I did think that it was interesting that he bought her a coat too, because I think that he intended to go to the north together, but I'm not sure.
I don't think it was too. I think he bought it and gave it to her to wear for the photo. But I think if she was going with him, I think he was basically going to like just jack her shit and give it to Gong Er.
I doubt it. No way.
She's like, sorry, bitch.
She's like, sorry, I found a new boo.
Oh my gosh. That was actually the way that they did it. It was this tenderness, but you could definitely see like they slowed down to show her reaction where she mm-hmm. could be able to see. And I didn't realize like it was probably the third time that they exchanged the button that I was like, oh shit, was that coat for Gong Er and not for his wife?
No, the coat was not for Gong Er. The button is off of his own coat, and the button was to say, I had such a strong intention to come see you that I had a coat made, but then I had to sell it, so I only have the button left.
Okay, yes. I saw he did cut off the button, but I was like, what?
It's more to say that, you know, he definitely had the intention and it was a serious, respectful intention.
He had to prove it. He's like, no, seriously, I was trying to come see you. It's not like I just left, I just ghosted you. And she's like, yeah, whatever. No, no, I kept the button of the...
Yeah, there's a lot you can talk about that, like, three-way relationship. And also, like, how Ip Man is always about the 64 hands. She's like, I loved you. And he's like, I want to see the 64 hands again.
That's definitely a euphemism, sure.
64 hands.
I want to see all 64 hands, you know what I'm saying? Oh my goodness. Okay. All righty. Well, it's been such a fun conversation. Again, out there, go see the original Chinese cut version of The Grandmaster if we had not convinced you enough. Otherwise, Pragya will come to your house.
I will cut you.
She will cut you like the executioner and his monkey.
Or the razor.
No, the razor.
Oh, like the razor. The razor. All right, everybody. Tune in next time for another episode of Real Asian Podcast.
See ya.
Yeah.
Hey there, thanks for tuning into this episode. Don't forget to follow us or subscribe to our podcast to get the latest episode now.